Welcome to Food Conversations, Season 3. Now, Food Conversations is a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds in the ground to watching them grow miraculously, harvesting and distributing food, and, of course, the end product, which is eating food. The program has a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Now, before we continue, I would like to acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for all of us. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back Jenny Wesley, co-operator of Greencroft Gardens, a long-standing organic family farm in North Grindrod. Now, last week, we covered Jenny's wandering ways when she started at age 3 chasing a killdeer down the road, to travels to Calgary, Vancouver, Italy, Toronto, Germany, Mexico, Spain, twice walking one of the Camino trails, not the standard one, but another one from south to north, walking a full 1,000 kilometers each time, and now coming back full circle to the farm where you live, Jenny, and were homeschooled for the first decade and a half of your life, back there since 2019. Jenny, welcome to Food Conversations once again.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for having me, Warren. It's really great to be here and to continue our conversation.
Absolutely. And you will hear, dear listeners, you will hear how intellectually curious and how diverse the interests are that Jenny holds in the world around her, including, you know, the standard stuff, going to school, studying political science for a while, going studying psychology at TRU, but also things like singing and writing music, of course, even busking at the Olympic Games in Vancouver, yoga, herbalism. You've covered the spectrum, Jenny, and we're going to explore that spectrum more today.
That sounds great.
So today we're going to focus on what you're doing now and what a lot of your thoughts and feelings are about what we are all doing right now with respect to food. So let's start with the farm. The farm in North Grindrod. Why don't you just give us an idea of the shape and size of this now becoming an institution in the local community?
All right. Well, our farm itself, we've had this farm. My parents bought the farm in 1987 when I was just a little toddler, a baby, I guess. and they began building on land that had nothing on it. They built a house, they built workshop fences, the whole 9 yards. The property that they own and that we work on is about 20 acres. We also lease another, I think, 12 acres that is partially under production as well. This way we can rotate crops and have enough room for everything.
And crop rotation is a big part of what is involved with a farm like this.
It is, especially for organic, because we do not use any, you know, chemical fertilizers of any kind, and we try to make sure the land has time to renew itself in between crops. Right. Yeah, we have also a lot of animals.
Speaking of animals, one animal that you told me about on the last show and that I was fascinated by is the little flock of sheep that you have, Icelandic sheep. Now, these are not your regular sheep. These are unusual animals. Describe.
These are special sheep.
Did your mom and dad, you know, look up 1,000 different kinds of sheep and say, that's the one we want? I mean, they must have done something in the way of researching.
They had other sheep a long time ago. I would want to say like in the early 90s. We had a problem with a cougar that came and actually killed a large amount of our flock at that time. And then we didn't have any for a long time. My mom loves everything about Iceland. She always has. and they also chose the sheep because they have different colored wool naturally. So that's very interesting if you're interested in wool. They also have short tails, which means no docking of the tails like normal sheep, which is more friendly to the animal.
And a little cleaner too.
Yeah, and their wool is just, it's special, and they're just a more wild sheep maybe to some degree.
Hmm.
But that also makes them very hardy and yeah.
Maybe.
We've got a flock of 20 ewes and 2 rams, and they're all about to have lambs any time now. So
so there's some long nights shaping
up. It'll be
up.
Fun seeing all the babies here soon.
their wool is excellent wool. And you've had the same fellow coming around to shear your sheep for 3 decades. That's
yeah,
pretty extraordinary.
Phil Copping, he's an Australian import. He's a Canadian that immigrated here from Australia and has been shearing our sheep, I think, for upwards of 20 years, probably more.
Yes, well, it's that kind of relationship that happens in a community like this. You know, mm-hmm. somebody is reliable and mm-hmm. people rely on them. That's the way it goes. You have some chickens, different kinds of chickens. Talk about.
We have different kinds of chickens. I was speaking with my parents and nobody knows exactly how many we have. somewhere between 80 and 90 hens, a mix of Rhode Island Reds, some Bantys, some Americana, and Greencroft chickens that are a little mix of everything. So those are mainly for laying eggs. Yeah, they're funny little flock.
And eggs are for more than just your own use. You must be producing enough that you...
We're getting... At the moment, we're getting somewhere around 70 eggs a day. So more than we can eat.
That's very eggy, very eggy. Now, plants. There's lots of plants on your property for food. Veggies, berries. Why don't you just run through a little bit of a list of what's growing there?
Truly, we grow basically everything we can in this area. We have raspberries, which are a permanent thing there, some fruit trees, mostly for ourselves, a little bit of other berries, some currants and josta berries, and then veggies, we grow everything, starting in the spring with greens, green onions, herbs. We've got everything in the summer, from cabbage, tomatoes, carrots, peppers, some odd things like radicchio or artichokes, which we grow small amounts of mostly for ourselves, but also just to have something fun for our customers. And then we do a lot of storage crops as well, because we do have a good storage facility here. So we do a lot of things for over the winter: potatoes, carrots, beets, onions, garlic, cabbages, and store those to sell at the market and to our restaurants during the winter.
And you have a greenhouse on the property?
We have one greenhouse, yes.
Yeah. And that's for seedlings.
Not super like heated. It's normally not heated. It's just for starting in the spring,
right.
Getting a head start on stuff, which is full of stuff right now.
I'm sure it will be and is and will be even more down the road. Did you have that childhood experience that everybody who's been near a garden cherishes, which is going out in the garden, picking something off a vine or out of the ground and sort of minimally cleaning it, like wiping it off with your hand and then and eating it?
Well, definitely. I'm kind of like a tomato obsessed person. So I've heard a lot of stories about how when I was little, I would pick basically all the cherry tomatoes and eat them. So that's my big thing. But definitely pulling carrots out of the ground or radishes and having them straight there, that's the best way.
Yeah, it does ruin you for store-bought stuff that's been sitting around for a couple of weeks on the shelf. It doesn't
cut
it.
It's just not the same.
No, it doesn't. Manure crops, green manure, is a very central concept to organic gardening. So why farming, gardening. Why don't you just lay out the sort of basic principle of how it works and what crops you use specifically on your farm?
So the idea of green manure is that you plant a crop that will not be used for consumption by humans. Instead, it grows on the land that is fallow in the moment, and then is tilled or worked back into the soil or just left to compost back into the soil to bring nutrients back in and to give the land a break from use.
Sure.
And allow it to restore itself. We use different crops, many different things we've used over the years. We use red clover. We've put some in oats, which then is just to use the oats for ourselves, but also then to work that back into the soil. Sure. At the end of the season. Yeah, we try to do that. So we do try to rotate our crops a lot so that no spot of land is overused too much.
And you have a little manure because you have, in addition to animals that produce food, you also or wool, you have a milk cow, who yes. I gather has a calf at this present time,
yeah.
and some horses.
We do, yeah.
For fun.
For fun, yes. So we have, it's my mom's little love. We have six horses, one donkey, and they are for fun and enjoyment and entertainment. And of course, like you said, we do use the manure from all our animals on our fields. Actually, just the day before yesterday, we had put manure on our rhubarb patch. But it was in big clumps on this patch. So it was a little bit too much in spots. So right. I spent the day,
using
a pitchfork and breaking it up. But, so we do use the manure from our animals to put back into the soil. It is a full circle thing.
Sure.
Which is how traditionally farms should be.
Yeah.
And what we're kind of aiming for is to be more and more self-sufficient and more circular in our process.
A number of people have said that it's very difficult to get enough specifically nitrogen in the soil unless you have animal manure. What's your thought on that? Because I mean, green manure, obviously clover is a nitrogen fixator, so it's a good way to get nitrogen in the soil, but how big a role does the animal manure play in?
I think it's very important.
Yeah.
I think that even in nature, that is how it works to some degree. I mean, animals, the herbivores are eating the greens and then putting the greens back into the soil, basically, through their natural process. I do think it's very important. I don't think it would work very well otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a consensus that's emerged over the years that animals have a place, and there's a lot of work on regenerative agriculture using animals. As long as you move them around, you don't leave them in one spot all the time.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned the donkey. So tell the story of this little donkey who was a donkey that was looking for love.
Yes, she was wandering, looking for a home. Her name is Lucy. She's a little miniature Sicilian donkey. I don't remember exactly when this was. This must be 15 years ago, at least, probably longer. She was a donkey at a neighbor's place by herself, was not happy, wanted friends, and she would consistently wander over and hang out with our horses. So at some point, I think the neighbor and my parents agreed that she was just needing a different environment. And so she ended up being a permanent fixture here and very popular.
Yes, she's a pleasant addition to the family.
She's a pleasant addition, yes. I can actually hear her right now. You probably can't, but she's saying it's time for a little bit of extra hay.
Yes, I'm learning more and more about how animals communicate and how we connect to them with people who are animal communicators, and how much animals are aware of what we are doing and how sensitive they are to how we behave. Something
Absolutely.
That we all have to start learning more about, I think. Speaking of animals, your brother has a herd of unusual little cows.
Yes. So my brother, Simon, who's the middle child of our family, him and his wife are looking to change their lifestyle a little bit. So they have bought a herd of six cows and a couple bulls that they are hoping to have for meat. These are low-lying cows, so they're an Angus mix. They are very stocky, almost like a full-size little cow, but very short legs. And they are apparently very easy to keep, easy calvers, and just an interesting different kind of breed. We've always kind of gravitated towards the interesting, I suppose, rather than the mainstream.
Now, we shouldn't talk about animals on the farm without talking about some of the animals that we would generally call companion animals. Let's talk. There's one dog, Summit, and three cats, plus your very own cat, who has participated in our interviews quite regularly and added a great tone to the conversation.
Yes, he's a goof. Yes, so we have Summit, who's a very big mutt. He's a 135-pound mixed puppy.
So how does a 135-pound dog, what kind of dog is that? That is a, besides being very large.
He's honestly a mutt. I don't think we know exactly what he is. He's partly Mastiff, partly Bernese Mountain Dog, we think, partly Australian Shepherd, possibly, or Cattle Dog. Hmm. He's black and white and brown and spotted. And he's a big baby.
And your cat is
Floki.
Yes. Everywhere.
Yes. And, he's outside. He's outside right now, probably chasing some mice.
Yes. And waiting to come back and tell you to open the door and let him in.
Yes. Yes.
So this farm, this wonderful, persistent farm that is now becoming the new way, which is the old way of growing food, Greencroft Gardens, was started up by your mom and dad because they were really highly motivated to do something like this. They came from Germany. They met in Germany while they were learning about farming, studying agriculture.
Yes.
I have this vision of your mom and dad out in the field one day, and your dad looks up and your mom looks up and they say, oh, who's that good-looking fellow over there, or that nice-looking woman, and having a conversation among the rows of, you know, beans or something like that. What was that origin story in actual fact, not my version?
So they did meet in agricultural school in Germany. They were both very young. They were, teenagers, I think, when they met. Mm. And met there. They were both interested actually in dairy farming. And both of them wanted to farm. Unfortunately, it was basically impossible to buy land in Germany.
Mm,
it still is, I think. I think you need to be multi-generational basically to get into that. And actually my mom's family decided to immigrate to Canada. So it was her whole family that wanted to immigrate. And my mom decided to go along because she was still under the age where she could go along as a family member, like as a child, a minor, rather than, I guess she was 21, but if she had waited, she couldn't immigrate with them and she'd have to immigrate on her own if she wanted to. So she decided to immigrate. And my dad, who had been to Canada in the 70s, decided to come along because he was in love and was interested in Canada. So they came in 1982 and got married in Canada right away. That way he could be sponsored by her. And I think they officially, like, the immigration actually came through, I think, in 87 or 88, officially.
Oh, really? So it was a five-year delay.
It was like after I was born, they officially became Canadian citizens. And they started out here working on dairy farms on the island and various other places, spent some time traveling across Canada to Ontario, seeing if there was a place that, you know, felt like home to them.
Were they sort of trying to get a feel for how agriculture is practiced in this part of the world? Because there's some differences. I mean, the land, for example.
I think that was definitely part of it, for sure. They wanted to see how things were different. And I also think because they were interested in dairy farming, they wanted to see if that was something they could do here, which they realized wasn't really very easy for them to start. And I think they also started getting interested in other types of farming. And they always had an idea and an interest in more holistic practices and in more natural practices. And so when they eventually settled here in the North Okanagan and the Shuswap area, they found this farm and were able to buy it and decided to venture into more vegetable growing.
Now, you, parenthetically, you also had an experience with dairy farming that turned you off conventional dairy farming. Just recapitulate a little bit, because I think that's relevant to this.
Yeah, I did work for almost 2 years milking cows in a conventional dairy farm. Not for me. It is very mechanized. It is very focused on the product and not on the animal at all. And I think we might talk about this a little bit later, that it is a food system flaw with the dairy industry, the fact that we have so much dairy here, and yet the actual milk ends up being shipped to places like Chilliwack or Calgary before coming back to our stores here.
Let's just focus on this, because I think we're going to be talking more about food systems, but this is a critical example of how distorted and inefficient food coming from the source, which is the animal or the plant, and then going to the consumer, how distorted that system is. And you just expand on that a little bit, because I think people need to know how crazy it actually is.
Well, I think over time, especially here in North America, it has become so centralized that we don't have, for example, a lot of food packaging systems in different areas, or we don't have food storage facilities for veggies in different areas, which were here in the Okanagan, for example, earlier for the fruit system. But I think it's just become so centralized that, unfortunately, even if there are things being grown or milk being produced, to get it into the bigger systems, you end up having to ship things back and forth to these places, to the dairy facilities or to food storage down at the coast before bringing it back to the Okanagan to sell it on the shelves. And this back and forth not only creates more fossil fuels, but it also makes a system that's only efficient for the big producers.
So your mom and dad were really heading directly opposite to that trend by buying a small farm. I mean, a small farm, 20 acres is, it depends, you know, it's a big farm.
Small.
It's small in the grand scheme of things, but it's a big place when you're a kid, especially. You got lots of room to run around. Do you, like when you're, parents were talking about this, Wolf and Gabby Wesley, when they were talking about this, obviously they became certified organic. I think you said it was one of the first farms in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly they had a vision that was at odds with the sort of general trend. How did that place them initially in the sort of food system process?
I think that they got very interested in organic, as I said, like they've been interested in that more holistic, more natural way. And I was talking with my dad, and they actually were looking at sort of niche markets where they could start making some money from the farm, and learned about a group called Wild West Organic, which was a wholesale group of all women who were interested in having a organic certification for BC for this area, so that things could be sold under the organic label and be monitored and made sure that you know, the protocol was being followed. And this was a group based out of Commercial Drive in Vancouver. And so my parents got certified through them in 1989.
Wow.
So this was very early on. And like, I think at that time, a lot of people scoffed at the organic label. Some people still do, maybe, but I think it was just not a, it was not a mainstream thing. It was not something that people were interested in many ways or aware of. So that's how they started with the organic officially.
It's also true that, that up until several years ago, you could label something organic just because you wanted to do so. You didn't have to become certified for selling in BC. A very peculiar situation was you had to be certified organic to sell outside BC, but within a province you could sell just by putting the name organic on the label.
It's kind of a greenwashing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Very peculiar. And a lot of people have said, and I talk about health issues in my office, and one part of that is food, and organic food is obviously preferable to conventionally raised food. And the issue of organic meaning something comes up all the time. You say, well, you know, anybody could put that on, and it's only that label on the food. It's only about 4 or 5 years ago that the rules were changed and it had to be certified organic within BC.
Now they just put natural on things.
Oh, I know. Well, that's another thing. All the words that are used to try and create the image of food that's good for you, even when it's not. So your parents were clearly kind of pioneers. And you grew up in this world where you could go and eat food, you know, eat all the cherry tomatoes if you wanted to, and you wouldn't, you might get indigestion, but you wouldn't get poisoned by some chemical that had been sprayed on them, which must have meant that you had this feeling about food that it was just something there that you take in, not something that you have to have done too far away, you know, goes off in a box and never comes back or something like that. When did you start becoming engaged in the farm, or was it as soon as you could toddle out in the fields, they got you picking something?
I think they got me doing things right away. I guess that's a benefit of having kids when you're a farmer, right?
It's cheap labor.
No, cheap labor.
Well, I mean, that has been a tradition in many parts of the world. You know, the children.
In some ways, I think that was happening a little bit, but it, you know, it's, I got interested in food right away, I think, as a child. And in some ways, like, I don't think you become aware of it as much until you're older and you look back and you realize, you know, how other people, your peers and other people you meet, how they've been raised and how they've been made aware of what food is. To me, I always understood food as, you know, these ingredients, things that you grow or things that you maybe buy, but ingredients that you make food with, as we know food as humans.
Sure.
For me, the idea of packaged foods, of, you know, these convenient foods was not such a big thing for me as a child, and still isn't. I still, like, it's stayed with me that I'm very much a cook. I cook my meals. I eat real food as much as possible.
Yeah, well, it's something that all of us are starting to realize is where food should be situated in our lives. We should be obtaining fresh stuff and making it into, you know, processing it in our own kitchens rather than in somebody's factory down the road. It wasn't always easy at the beginning. The support system for organic farming and for small farmers when your mom and dad started out wasn't as robust as it is today, and it's got a long way to go still, but it's more firm than it used to be. What was that like? There must have been moments. I know 2008 was a big challenge for a lot of people and a lot of parts of the employment world. What was that like for you watching this happen?
I know that 2008 was a very big moment in the world. And I was speaking with my parents a little bit about this because I wasn't actually here in 2008. I was doing my own thing at that time. And they spoke actually a little bit more about how difficult it was in the 90s for them because they were starting out and because there wasn't that same support for what they were doing at that time. They actually said the 2008 recession did not have as big of an impact on them as one would think.
Because they're already established?
Because they're established. And they were saying that the biggest growth actually for them, and they felt in the industry itself, in the small organic industry, was during 2002 to 2008, that people really began to get on board with this sort of first initial wave of support, of understanding that this was something that was important and viable. So for them, by the time 2008 rolled around, it wasn't actually as big of an impact on them. It might have been for smaller farmers or people starting out at the time, for sure.
So when your parents were starting out and the support system wasn't as developed as it is now, what did they do? How did they deal with that sense of, you know, starting out and being a bit isolated?
So I will tell a little story, actually, that we were talking about. So this must have been early 90s because I was apparently, or maybe, yeah, probably was early 90s because apparently I was a little toddler. They had a little green Toyota truck. So both my parents in the front seats, me in the middle in my car seat, squished in there. And they loaded up the back as far as they could load it with tomatoes and watermelon, which is what they had, I guess, a lot of that year.
My goodness.
And they started driving north and stopped at every fruit stand to try to sell what they had. And they stopped and they stopped and they stopped and nobody was buying. And again, I think this is probably because a lot of things were imported and super cheap.
Right.
So buying something local was just not financially viable for these fruit stands. And they ended up driving all the way actually to Williams Lake, which, as my mom said, as far as north as she has ever gone here in BC. And they eventually stopped at a fruit stand where the person said, you know what, if you sell this all for 5 cents a pound, I'll buy it from you.
5 cents a pound.
5 cents a pound. So they did. They sold it. They said they got $50 an ice cream and used that money to drive back here and start all over again.
That must have been hugely discouraging for your mom and dad to
must be, because it's a story they still talk about.
Yes, right. It's a seared in their memories. So what did they do after that? Obviously, that didn't work. So what was
that
the
didn't
next thing?
Work? So they continued farming. They did tried other things. They did some bedding plants and more flowers. And actually, between 91 and 96, my dad worked as a dairy tester, which is someone who goes to dairy farms and takes samples of the milk for laboratory testing to make sure everything is, you know, right. Okay, and there's not an overabundance of antibiotics in the milk and so on and so forth. So he did that for 5 or 6 years during the 90s when they were struggling the most to get started and to get really established here. And then they did try different things. They actually were the first people in BC, I think, to import spelt, which is a grain that's related to wheat.
Sure.
And they imported the spelt from Germany and started growing it here, and they had milling equipment. This was also not financially viable, didn't pan out to make money, but they actually ended up selling that equipment to when the pea growers, which was a place in Armstrong that milled grains, shut down. There was nowhere to mill grains here and to clean and process grains. And so there was a co-op created, and they sold their equipment to this co-op, and my dad helped them set it up. And this was, I think, in the early 2000s, 2002 perhaps. And he helped them set that up, and that became Fieldstone Granary, which is still in Armstrong.
For sure.
So he did that for a while, and that was also like a way to help us supplement financially.
Sort of value added, as it were.
Value added, yeah. But then he found, like you said, then the biggest growth really began in that early to mid 2000s.
And that, when you say growth, you're talking about the general public starting to say, we want local food. We want fresh food. Yeah. We want healthy food.
That's when it really, the ball started rolling with people actually supporting farmers markets and not coming and just saying, you know, I want 5 cents for your for your tomato, or else I can go somewhere else. People started actually showing interest and making an effort to support more local.
I can only imagine your parents' feelings when somebody offered them a whole truckload of 5 cents a pound for a whole truckload of food. It must have been a dark moment at that time. The process of support has gradually expanded and built up. Why don't we talk about that a little bit, how the evolution of support for organic farming has taken place? Obviously, it's influenced your parents, but it's also influenced you in terms of coming back to the farm and seeing possibilities that weren't necessarily available to them 25 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, I think like the growth has been keeping going since that 2002 to 2008 period. And I think as a new generation started growing up, things have shifted too, because I think the previous generations did grow up in this very cheap food system. And now, especially as millennials, we've become more and more aware of environmental issues. And I think with internet and all of that, that's become more and more in people's consciousness. And I do see for myself that at markets, the slightly younger generation are really shifting more and more to valuing food. Because I think that even I remember as a young person going to markets, maybe in the early 2000s, how many people were just not interested in paying money for food. It was just not, you know, you tried to get as cheap as possible and eat whatever was the cheapest.
Yeah, no, that is definitely a trend that was very, very
strong. I think it's shifted a lot in everybody, but it is very encouraging to see the younger generations showing that food is valuable and it is precious. And I think that's been a big factor in the more recent growth.
I'm struck. You said something a while back about the fact that the entity on Commercial Avenue in Vancouver, Wild West Organics, was or is all women running it. Mm-hmm. And I'm very struck by the fact that so many of these ventures that involve kind of caring for the planet, kind of thinking about, you know, protecting what we've got and healing the wounds of human activity, which are all over the place and becoming still expanding, and we have a lot of work to do there. But maybe just comment a little bit on, from your perspective as a woman, what you see is the reason, because it's definitely a trend, the reason for women playing such a central role in expanding the kinds of systems that give us real security in the short and the long run.
I think honestly, if I'm looking deep in myself, I think it's just a natural sort of feminine urge, mm-hmm. to be caregivers, to be the people tending to the wellness of others. And it's not necessarily just women. I think it's just the more feminine side in everybody.
Sure.
But I think that is perhaps what it is. It's just that women have a more natural inclination to looking after things. And I think we all, as men and women and masculine and feminine, we're all aware of the issues that are happening in the world. I think perhaps it comes down to just the nature of people.
Sure. No, I think that's true. I mean, obviously for women, it's more natural to do that. It's sort of maybe instinctive. There may be some biological reasons, but also social reasons as well. But I'm noticing on this show that I interview a lot of women and young women in particular, because there seems to be a genuine shift in demographics in terms of many industry, the so-called care sector, generally speaking, seems to be where there are major expansions and transformations taking place. And one of them is to have women play a central role, a decision-making and organizing role, not just, you know, helping out, but actually making decisions and plans about how next steps should be taken.
And I think perhaps it has become a way for women to really take a very central role, is to take on these topics and these projects and these causes that maybe have been a little bit abandoned in general by our society. And now being able to take those on and make actual solutions and make action plans and take steps to fix them is also a way to gain some power.
Sure.
In its own way, and to take a more central role in what is happening in our world.
Well, I think we've seen too many examples of the imbalance created by a totally masculine approach to interactions and political behavior and that kind of thing. It hasn't always been successful. In fact, right now we're watching some public events that are rather dramatically unsuccessful.
Yes.
So your mom and dad, you as kids on the farm, things are progressing over the years, and you built up quite a sound customer base, primarily heading south initially. Now it's a little more heading north, but initially much of it was going down to Kelowna, to markets there, and establishing interesting relationships with some of the wineries who want fresh vegetables and fruits to go along with their product. Talk about that a little bit. Because you would have seen it.
Yeah. Well, my parents initially started trying every market. So they had tried Salmon Arm 30 years ago and, you know, Sycamose and Vernon, and tried them all. Hmm. When they started in Kelowna, which is about 24 years ago, something like that, it initially was the place that seemed like it had the most support for them. And they've done that market for a long, long time.
And this was farmers' markets?
This was the farmer's market, farmer's market in Kelowna. And it was a very successful market for them, especially at the beginning. And especially during that time, 2002 to 2008, there wasn't as much competition. And it did seem like the population itself was very supportive. And they did get offers from restaurants and wineries that were interested in latching onto this kind of trend of organic and local. And so they got in very early and were able to establish good relationships with them, especially Mission Hill Winery has been a longtime supporter. Quail's Gate Winery was a longtime supporter. And more recently, we've actually got a bunch more restaurants that are very supportive, such as Waterfront Wines. Rod's restaurant has been super supportive of us, Sprout Kitchen, and a few others.
And what do they tell your dad and you? What do they tell you that they like about what you do and what and the food you bring them? What keeps them going?
I think the biggest thing is honestly the quality and the taste of the actual vegetables. I mean, these are very high-end places. These are places that, you know, a lot of people have a hard time affording, myself included. But they want something that tastes good. They want something that really will highlight their wines and actually, you know, have a real taste to it. And they, you know, they say our products and probably products of other local small farmers are just incomparable to whatever you buy from Sysco or another place that's just buying the cheapest produce from wherever. And I think that's the reason they come back.
Of course. And it makes perfect sense because there's evidence that, for example, with organic foods, defense compounds are more abundant because the plants are not relying on or are not protected by some kind of artificial pest control, insecticides or fungicides or whatever. And many of these defense compounds are flavors. They produce the actual taste of the food. So the scientific basis for organic food tasting better is firmly established now. It was speculated about for a long time, but now it's really quite clear that it is a fact. Organic.
I wonder too sometimes if because the soil itself is more healthy.
Oh, absolutely.
And not like the ground's not leached out by chemicals, that perhaps the amount of minerals and vitamins and nutrients in the food itself is higher. And that probably also leads to us feeling like it tastes better because of that as well.
Yeah, and many of these compounds actually turn out to be good for human health. They augment, for example, our antioxidant protection system. They give us immune stimulation, our body's immune stimulation. So there's a mutual benefit from the food.
Win-win.
Absolutely. So Jenny, now that we've established that the benefits of the food that is grown on the farm, why don't you talk a little bit about, I was thinking of a sort of a typical day. I'm sure on a farm there's no such thing as a typical day because it's so driven by season, it's driven by growth, it's driven by observations made in the field. But kind of outline this sort of the pattern that would say, I mean, right now, okay, it's seeding, it's getting in food started in the ground. Why don't you just kind of give a sense of what the arc of a day is like on a small organic farm in North Grindrod?
Well, like you said, it does vary a lot. So my days will start anywhere between 4 in the morning when it was that heat wave last year, or maybe 9 in the morning in the winter when things are a lot slower and colder. So that it's very hard to say exactly. But at this moment, for example, now with the spring starting, my days usually start around 6:30 when I get myself out of bed. And then we start the morning with looking after animals. So everybody needs to be fed and watered and checked on, check that the sheep haven't all popped out their lambs yet. And then I usually get started with either things in the greenhouse or things out in the field, getting either things seeded, watering greenhouse, looking after getting our beds ready to plant outside. I've been picking a lot of rocks out because we are establishing a new permanent spring garden where I'm going to be growing herbs. So it had a lot of rocks in it. So it's been a lot of lifting.
Isn't it amazing how the ground is very fertile when it comes to rocks? It grows them very well.
It grows lots of rocks. So it really does vary a lot depending on the day and the time of year. But I'm usually out there either working in the field or in the greenhouse at the moment.
And then when things actually start to grow and they are reaching what you might call marketable size or volume or whatever, that changes things, right? That's when Absolutely. You start to moving things around. How's that transition like?
So, yeah, well, we'll have our first sort of crops planted fairly soon here. And then we start harvesting what there is a couple times a week, usually. We do have markets a few times a week, so we try to pick everything the day before, sort of as fresh as possible for our market. And as the season progresses, some crops end, and then that gets replanted with the next round of vegetables.
Sure. And then you have to take them somewhere.
Yeah.
Now, you were saying earlier that the market in Kelowna has been your major target, but now you're sort of shifting north to some of the smaller markets.
Yeah, we've found over especially the last, I want to say 5 to 10 years, things have shifted for us in Kelowna. I think the population has grown a lot in Kelowna, but the support itself hasn't grown with the population. So for us, we find in terms of our goal, we want to be closer to home. And I think that is also a more environmentally friendly option, even though Kelowna isn't really that far away. If you look at the grander scale of the food system, now we're focusing more on establishing in Salmon Arm, in Enderby. We have a Kingfisher market out Maple Lake in the summer. And we also have a farm store at our farm on Thursdays, which we hope to maybe change to being a 2 or 3 day a week thing, because it is also nice to have people come to the farm. This way they can really see what's happening. They can see the animals. They can take a walk through the fields. It gives people a better perspective of what it actually entails to be a farm. And so for us, that is our big thing, is trying to be more local and trying to be more community involved and a little bit more on the teaching side, a little bit more on the education. And I'm finding the Salmon Arm market very great. It's been a super support to us, and it's been super just getting to know the community itself.
So you're presenting the notion of not just producing food and selling it to people who want to eat. There's also the process of looking at the system that produces the food, thinking about how it works, why it works, what parts of it don't work. And you also have another side, which is in your Facebook page, it's Magical Activist. And that's the side of talking about, not just talking about food, but also using food for special purposes, things like healing, things like energy enhancement and that kind of stuff. You've studied at the Evolutionary School of Herbalism in Portland. And obviously that was something that is also part of the mix in your own relationship with the land and with food. Why don't you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest, I think even food itself, even just vegetables, are energetic, and they do offer us a lot of healing qualities, like you said, with the defense mechanisms being antioxidants. It's not just one specific plant that does that. Everything we eat does. I just got very interested in herbs for my own use. I found that certain plants make me feel a certain way.
You mentioned yarrow and stinging nettle to me.
Yarrow and stinging nettle are one of my favorites. I actually took a little bit of a yarrow tincture this morning. I find that it's strengthening, it's balancing, it helps me feel more grounded. And so for me, it kind of started as a little bit of a personal experiment.
Right.
And I've always kind of had this dream of having a beautiful herb garden, which I'm starting to work on this spring, actually. So making some proper raised beds and going to have a permanent place for them. I'm interested in just teaching people more about, you know, connecting with nature and connecting with their environment. And I think sometimes a very good way of doing that is through our taste buds.
Absolutely.
And so I do like creating teas and creating other products that are not only healthy, but also tasty, and let people experience things through their sensory capacities.
Yes. No, indeed. It's interesting because herb gardens were absolutely all over the place in medieval times and in past times, in many, many historical epochs. Herbs to enhance the food, enhance the flavor, some of the other attributes of the food, make it more healthful, preserve it. Many herbs were used to preserve food. So it's clearly expanding back. We're expanding back into a more complete relationship.
Absolutely. And I mean, a lot of these herbs also were the basis of medicine, like medicines we still use now, for example.
For sure.
Willow has the same compounds as aspirin.
Indeed. Salicylic acid.
Yeah, exactly. And I made some tinctures of willow, which I take if I have, you know, some cramps or a headache. And it really does work. And it's more gentle on your system.
Yes, indeed.
It's more gentle on your system. And people don't realize how much actually what we use as modern medicine came from this.
Every operation that takes place involving entering a body cavity, and there are many of those operations around the world, uses curare as its base. It's been modified chemically to enable the pharmaceutical industry to make more money out of it. But nevertheless, it's the same compound that is used in rainforests in the Amazon basin for hunting purposes. It paralyzes the animal and allows its quick dispatch. Fortunately, it's not used for that purpose with humans, I'm pleased to say.
It's just that plants themselves, I guess, can't be monetized very easily by pharmaceuticals.
No. And which I think... We've got about five more minutes, and I want to talk a little bit about that whole way the system is set up now, with emphasis on profits concentrated in a small set of pair of hands. This incredible system of long distance food transport, the use of inexpensive labor, part of your moniker that you've created for yourself is magical activist, and the activist is that part of you that says, no, this isn't the kind of system we should be having. Why don't you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think that a lot of it comes down to the capitalist system we live in, which I don't think there's anything wrong with money. I think that that's fine. I think that it's completely out of balance at the moment.
Yeah, it's how it's distributed that matters.
And I think for the food system itself, like I had talked about the centralization of things, and being basically required to ship things in order to process them into, for example, if you wanted to can 50,000 cans of beans, you would have to ship them somewhere totally far away and then ship them back in order to sell them in your area. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, with Zest Food Hub, for example, in Salmon Arm, things are shifting, but it hasn't been like that for a long time. And I think also a big thing is the overregulation of foods. I was speaking with my parents about in the prairies, they grow a lot of peas. And then those peas were used for making pea protein, which people would use pea protein in different products. But they could not get the regulations to set up the pea protein processing plant in Saskatchewan. And so these people were sending the peas to France, where they would process it into pea protein and then send it back to Canada. But the regulations in France are not the same regulations that they would want here. So why didn't the regulations matter when you have to ship them across the world, but they matter if you want to process it here? This is...
Yeah, we've built a... that's a beautiful example of how crazy the food production system has become.
And I think the real solution is to... try as much as possible and in many ways as possible in the food industry to diversify what we have here and to manufacture or, you know, process what we have here.
There's an interesting parallel that you just touched on, and that is that natural systems that are robust and resilient are diverse. They have lots of little pockets of growth of the same plant or animal scattered throughout the system rather than having it all concentrated in one place or a monocultural growing process. And really what you're talking about, seems to me, is returning to a more naturalistic way of growing food that we eat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think a big thing that the public can do, that people can do as individuals, is just vote with your dollars.
Yes, indeed.
It is. Unfortunately, we live in a system where money talks. Money talks more than basically anything. It's sad, but it is what it is. And I think if people try as much as they can And it's not about being perfect, but to support local as much as they can. Even, I want to say support organic, but even if you can't always support organic, still supporting local over a conventional one from far away, you're still making a difference. And trying as much as possible to just reduce the money you give to big business. You know, there was that Kellogg strike not that long ago, and look at what a boycott on them did. It made a big difference. It made them scared.
Yes. And I think you're right. I would agree with you completely that the way to change the system is to show a better system, or to show a system that works more effectively and gives us sort of what we want, but also makes it attractive to us. Yeah. So when you're in the farmer's market, you must have a lot of people coming up and talking about how they like eating food that tastes good and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Do you see, you said there's a trend. Is the trend building towards better, high quality local food?
I think it is. I think people are really becoming more and more aware of it. And I think lots of things contribute to it. For example, even what's happened in the last year with flooding and people realizing, wow, if we do get cut off from outside sources, we have to rely on what we have here. The world, you know, it doesn't just magically arrive here. And I think even little things like that do shift perspectives in people who maybe weren't as on board as before.
Oh, yes. I think when people saw empty shelves in the local grocery stores and saw that the products that were grown locally and the farmers market were full, there was lots of food in both settings.
Because it is here.
It is here. And it's only just a matter of us making a point of just following the lead that farms like Greencroft Gardens are setting out for us. And that's a future that we can all look forward to. Jenny, we're coming to a close now. I want to thank you very much for being on the show both times. We've all learned a lot from your experiences, and I'm sure you'll continue learning because you've been a learner for forever. And I'm sure we'll enjoy hearing more from you in the future. Thank you very much, Jenny.
Thank you so much, Warren, and everyone there. It's been a pleasure.